Welcome to the Teaching Journeys podcast, hosted by Dave Roberts. Humanity possesses a unique skill, the ability to pass knowledge from one generation to the next. This podcast embraces that ability, offering learning opportunities through conversations with extraordinary guests. Dave aims to leave a positive mark on individuals around the world. So before you dive into today's episode, please share this podcast with your network, including friends, family, and colleagues. And please consider leaving a rating or review. Your support makes all the difference.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Teaching Journeys podcast. I'm your host, Dave Roberts. And today, it is my pleasure to have as my guest, Russ Telep. Russ Telep is a certified brain spotting and trauma-informed somatic coach and founder of Brain Spotting Colorado Springs, whose mission is to provide a safe and compassionate space for addressing trauma, anxiety, and other life challenges. With extensive experience in brain spotting therapy and trauma-informed coaching, Russ is deeply committed to helping clients unlock their potential, process past experiences, and cultivate lasting well-being. Russ, welcome to the Teaching Journeys podcast. It's a pleasure having you on the program today.
Thanks for having me, Dave. I'm excited to be here.
And I'm excited to have you. And we got to give a shout out to Chris Mamone. Chris Mamone is a great podcaster himself. He's the host of the Empowered Grief Journey podcast. He introduced us. We found that we aligned on many levels with our journeys and with our beliefs about trauma and doing trauma-informed therapy. And we find ourselves today doing a podcast. And I understand you have another project going on with Chris. Would you like to share that with us?
Yeah. So we've been working on, over the course of the last year, an anthology with 21 other authors and then 23 with the two of us. And it's being released on November 15th. And it's the Empowered Grief Journey, 25 Stories That Carved a New Path Forward. And we're going to do some sort of live or something on Facebook as a launch event type thing.
Yeah, I know Chris, that's a project that he's very passionate about. He told me about the structure of the project. And, you know, he's on Facebook and other social media sites. He's put out who some of the authors are going to be. And it sounds like he's assembled a very impressive group of impactful individuals.
Yeah, everybody from the calls and stuff. Now, I haven't even had the opportunity to read any of it yet because we haven't even gotten advanced readers yet. But based on the calls and the interactions we've had so far, these are amazing people. They've got amazing stories. I went into it thinking I was going one direction and just got taken a completely different direction. I went into it being a specialist in trauma-informed coaching and narcissistic abuse. I went into it thinking I was going to be writing about the grief that you feel after a narcissistic abusive relationship when that ends. But then as I sat down and wrote it, I ended up writing about my father, who I never thought of as someone that I grieved, but turns out I did. So it's really interesting. It's going to be a really powerful, impactful book. I'm really excited about it coming out.
Yeah, me too. And I'm excited about getting my hands on a copy once it does come out. So I know... Oh, go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt.
The plan for that is November 15th, but now we're trying to get the copywriting and all that stuff done. And I guess because of the government shutdown now, we're having some troubles with that. So it may get delayed a little bit. But sometime in the second half of November, it should get released.
Yeah, I'll be looking for it. So I know you're a trauma-informed coach. Tell our audience about the experiences that have shaped that path to you becoming a trauma-informed coach. Tell us just a little bit about the backstory that has led you to this moment.
So the short version is I was married twice. Toward the end of the second marriage, I was being awakened to the point that trauma was something that was going on in my life. I'd never been aware of it prior to this. I thought I was always pretty well adjusted, you know, and I wasn't by any means. My life was being ran by trauma responses rather than me controlling them. So it's as I started doing some therapy and some things toward the end of that relationship, it really brought me into the fold of healing, and I wouldn't shut up about it. I'm talking to everybody about trauma this, trauma that, trauma this, trauma that, after doing some of these modalities like breath work and some other things. I had somebody ask me one day, like, dude, if you're gonna talk about this like this, why don't you do this for a living? I was like, yeah, that's a good idea. So I started getting some certifications and learning, and here I am.
Yeah, that is an interesting path. And, you know, it's interesting is, you know, because we are individuals who are really beset by trauma. Trauma really drives the bus. Usually it's our rational mind and our rational problem-solving mind that usually drives the bus. But when trauma really hits, you're talking about trauma really driving the bus, and it becomes a really kind of reactive, almost survival mechanism to just kind of get through minute to minute and day to day existence dealing with the after effects of trauma.
Yeah. If you imagine the brain is like your fist, right?
And yeah.
Prefrontal cortex up here. And this is that connected presence, right? This is where your rational thought is, intelligent thought, connection with other people, all of that lives up here. But when you go into a trauma response, that goes offline, and that's when the limbic system takes over. Once the limbic system takes over, the prefrontal cortex is no longer in the, in the fold.
No, and you're right. The limbic system does control that trauma influence response to anything. And we end up dealing more with our emotions and impulsivity than we do anything else. Or any type of rational or logical decision making goes out the window because we're constantly responding to the stress signals that our brain is sending out.
I learned through all the training and stuff that I've done in somatics and in the nervous system, polyvagal, that sort of thing, is the brain is sending out those signals. The brain is pumping out those hormones to mobilize energy for you to be able to fight or flight. But that's not where it originates. It originates in the body.
Yeah. And, you know, as Bessel van der Kolk's book outlines, the body does know the score. We keep trauma in all parts of our body. I mean, you can tell an individual who is traumatized just by the way they walk, by the way they shuffle their gait, by the way they maintain eye contact, just in terms of facial expression, muscular tension, any of that. You can tell just by verbally, and I think non-verbally, how they react to the world, how they react to other people.
Oh, yeah, especially if you're an empathetic type person. You know, a lot of people who have survived abusive situations, whether it be narcissistic or even psychotic abuse, they tend to be empathic people.
Yeah.
And empathic people who, like Carl Jung calls it the evolved empath, right? So they're the empath that has gone through some of the healing, and their empathic behavior isn't a crutch or isn't a downfall, but more of a superpower. You can pick them out of a crowd as they're walking because you can see that tight shoulder. But the thing that's crazy is a lot of us carry trauma that you can't see. They look perfectly normal, like they're functioning really well, when in reality, that trauma is controlling a large portion of their lives. It's very, very little time that we spend present and connected. Most of it we spend ruminating.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, playing the traumatic event over and over in our head, either to make sense of it or because that traumatic event is actually just dominating our lives.
Yeah.
You know, I remember working with a client when I was an addictions counselor. He had PTSD, and you're probably talking about all kinds of stress from seeing his brother get killed in his arms or a drive-by shooting. And so he self-medicated to deal with that. But he said, every time he went to sleep, he saw his brother's face. He saw his brother before he got shot. And he replayed the image in his head of his holding his brother until he died. And that fueled a lot of stress-related responses and also fueled a lot of self-medication to manage the stress-related responses, which, you know, when he finally got into treatment, you know, we and our interdisciplinary team needed to do a lot of really intensive therapeutic approaches with him in a short-term period of time just to get him stabilized and, you know, plant some tools for dealing with stress and also for having that prefrontal cortex, that decision-making part of our brain, come back into play again. But yeah, I mean, that's the one scenario that comes to mind when we talk about, you know, stress-informed responses, stress-related responses, and, you know, continued survival responses to stress. So,
absolutely. Yeah. And when I say that the end of that relationship is what started the journey, it's what started the journey, but the end of the relationship is not the trauma that I was dealing with. It was putting a spotlight on the trauma that I was dealing with. All of the relationships that I've had throughout my life, friends, coworkers, romantic, family, all of them shined a spotlight on these beliefs about myself, these core beliefs of not being good enough, not being lovable. And that's what basically came from a childhood just chock full of physical abuse, sexual abuse, emotional abuse, all the way up until, you know, 18 years old. So all that programming that happens in childhood, even your friend that had his friend die in his arms, his reaction to that may or may not be also informed by childhood events as well, if that makes sense.
Yep. Yeah, it makes perfect sense. Yeah, but early experience matters. And, you know, whenever there's physical abuse, emotional abuse, sexual abuse, or even if a child is witnessing abuse, if that narrative isn't redefined, or if we don't help individuals take back the narrative and recreate a narrative that's going to lead to more pro-social and healthier behaviors, that child is going to take that early childhood experience. It's going to impact everything, their work relationships, their significant other relationships, who they choose to relate to. And a lot of times they may replicate relationships that mimic the dynamics that they grew up with at home because that's all they knew.
Yeah, the body or the brain strives for balance, even if that balance comes from someone else.
Yeah.
And we will look for the caregiver that was supposed to give us care that, I hate using the word failed to do so because it's not a failure, right? Like I have even passed trauma onto my daughters, right? That I got from my father. He got trauma from his father that he passed on to me. Generational trauma is real. And we all do the best that we can with how we're brought up. So even though my father was not a very good person, he was a liar. He was abusive. He was a terrible person. And I don't forgive him for the events that happened in my childhood. I have moved forward and I no longer dwell on it. But it's not like I'm justifying his behavior by saying there's a reason for it. He wasn't born a monster. You know, it came from somewhere. And that was a realization I had in some psychedelic treatments that I did a few years ago. It was an immediate shift in the way that I viewed him because I've always hated him from the time that I joined the military and left up until about 3 years ago. When he died in 2020, my brothers and I celebrated. We were like, the world's a better place. Now, after that treatment, I look at him more with pity than disdain. Because I know that he probably endured a lot of the same abuse that I did. It's just him guided him on one path and mine guided me on another.
Yeah. And, you know, if you set up that history occurred with him, if he was a part of that history, that's going to get passed down. The dynamics, the rules, everything. I mean, and without the genetic code even being altered, you know, that's going to get passed down from generation to generation to generation. Again, unless the narrative is reclaimed.
We talk about generational trauma going back seven generations. An interesting fact in my family is seven generations ago was Martha Washington, right? So I'm carrying trauma that Martha Washington and George Washington passed on to their kids and stepchildren from the Revolutionary War.
Yeah.
You know, that's crazy to think of that you're just stacking stuff on top of each other. And if you look at a lot of my family, you know, they've not excelled in a lot of ways. We've battled through stuff to get where we're at, you know. But we didn't come with generational wealth. We didn't come with great family history and all the things that a lot of families did. But we've still been able to be successful. Luckily, the last 3 years has just been life-changing for me. So I look at my life and who I am today, and I don't recognize myself from even a year ago, even 6 months ago. I'm just on this constant forward path of growth. That's the really cool thing about healing trauma is as it begins to heal, you're no longer healing, you're growing, yeah. Right? You go from healing to growth. And that is that transition where you realize, okay, I've dealt with a lot of this stuff. Now I'm actually becoming a better, I don't want to say a better person. Let me say this. You're becoming the best possible version of yourself.
Yeah. And growth goes on a continuum. You know, we're never going to stop growing until the day that, you know, we meet our maker. And the day I stop growing is the day I check for a pulse and the day that I probably need to reevaluate and say, you know, why have I stopped being a learner? Why have I stopped looking for opportunities that are going to allow me to continue to evolve? I don't think that's ever going to happen. My dealing with trauma, my experience with trauma has told me that I need to continue to grow. I need to continue to expand, and I need to continue to be, as you so aptly put it, continue to be the better version of myself.
So, and the best version of yourself tomorrow is going to be different than the best version of yourself today.
And I
continuously grow, and you're constantly moving forward.
I welcome that continued growth and evolution every day. You mentioned generational trauma. From your experience of working with your clients, how is generational trauma influenced an individual's response to crisis? How do you see those two playing out?
My grandfather served in the Korean War. He was apparently very different after he came back from the war.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result of that, he raised and treated my father differently than he would have had he not gone to the Korean War, not served in the Korean War, and experienced the traumas that he did over there. My father, because he was treated by his father in a certain way, grew up with that childhood trauma, also served in the military on the border of East and West Germany during the Cold War. Him raising me the way that he raised me, so I've got all these compiled traumas because the stuff that my grandfather treated my father differently created trauma, which caused him to treat me differently, which created trauma, which caused me to treat my daughter differently, which created trauma. And a lot of the stuff basically is when you don't feel like you're valuable enough to matter, right? Or that feeling of not being enough will essentially run every decision you make. So every decision you make going forward throughout your entire life, that's the thing that you're going back to as the litmus test, right? Is this going to prove that I'm enough? If you meet a person or a mate, you get married, try spending your life together, but you're operating from this position of not feeling like you're enough. So you're constantly trying to win their affection. You're constantly trying to give to try to get back from them. Because I was raised by a father who, you were never enough. You could never meet the standard.
And that's a consistent message that comes out of unhealthy homes is you're not enough. You're not enough.
And I'm sure that my daughter would say the exact same thing, that she felt like she was never enough. So it's now, unfortunately, it's too late for me to break the cycle with her, but hopefully she can break the cycle with her kids.
Yeah, and as long as that cycle gets broken, that the cycle of generational trauma will get broken as well, too.
Absolutely. And, yeah. Plus, it's just miserable to live wallowing in crappy memories, you know? It's just to ruminate over things and just never feel like you've done enough, that you are enough, that you could ever be enough. You know, that's a miserable place to be.
Absolutely. Regardless of the nature of the trauma, yeah, that's a miserable place to be. Now, I know you're a trauma-informed somatic coach.
Correct.
Now, if I were a client of yours, what could I expect from you as a coach? What type of tools could I expect to acquire to help me deal with my own personal trauma and generational trauma?
Yeah. So the first thing I typically do with a client during our initial session is we'll sit down and we'll do what's called a nervous system mapping. So we'll go through the different states of the Polyvagal Ladder. Are you familiar with the Polyvagal Ladder?
I've heard of the Polyvagal Ladder, okay. But educate me.
Okay, great. So at the top of your ladder, you're up here in your prefrontal cortex. This is when you're rest and digest state, right? So this is when you can rest, you can heal, you can connect with others, you feel safe. This is safety. If something happens that triggers a trauma response, you get pushed down to the center of the ladder, which is your sympathetic nervous system. This up here would be your parasympathetic nervous system. Yeah. Down here is your sympathetic nervous system. This is about a 200 million year old part of the polyvagal nerve, the vagus nerve. And this is where fight or flight lives. Yep. Fight, flight, flee. Yeah. So if for some reason this doesn't resolve the trauma or get you back to this, because that's ultimately the goal for your brain is to be here. So if you get pushed down here and this doesn't work, it's going to push you down here into the dorsal vagal system. The dorsal vagal system is where your free state lives, freeze, fawn, stuff of that nature. So what I do in that first session is we figure out, okay, how much time during the day do you spend here? How much do you spend here? And how much do you spend here? And then we start going through and figuring out, mapping out the triggers that cause us to go into those states, what those states physically feel like, and what we can do to move ourselves up the ladder into the next state. What I find is most people spend about 5% of their day connected up in that connected space, in that present space. The majority of their time is spent ruminating. The majority of their time is spent inside their head or in one of those trauma states. So then we'll talk about safety and what safety feels like. Because a lot of us, Dave, it's amazing how many of us don't know what safety even feels like. Yeah. I did a post on Facebook about a year ago and I asked, what does love feel like? People would say it feels like flowers on a summer morning. It feels like the breeze from the ocean when I sit on my back porch. It feels like the smell of a baby's breath. It feels different things, right? It feels like the smell of my wife's perfume. And then I asked, what does betrayal feel like? And everybody's like, it feels like someone's got a knife in my stomach. It feels like I'm being choked and I can't breathe. It feels like I have an elephant on my chest. All these physical experiences, right? Because we spend so much time in those trauma responses, we know exactly what that feels like. But how many of us can say exactly what love feels like in our body? Like if you were just to describe love, Dave, how would you describe the physical sensations of love?
Warmth in my heart, pep in my step, constant smile on my face, elevated mood, just wanting to be engaged in life and feeling at peace, and that would manifest in terms of my breathing. My breathing would probably be more relaxed. It would be more full. My fine motor and gross motor movements would be precise. I wouldn't be shuffling. There would be a freedom in that, a freedom to feel love, and that's how that would manifest in my body, my mind, and my spirit.
Yeah, see, most people could not describe what love feels like as well as you just did. Because most people are not as in touch with their physical sensations. It's really important to be in touch with what your body is telling you because it can tell you everything you need to know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it tells you if you're nauseous and you need to throw up. It tells you if you have to go to the bathroom. It tells you if you're hot. It tells you if you're cold. So why not listen to it when it tells you that you're going through something?
Mm-hmm.
So you need to process something, that you need to stop, take a break, and allow yourself to heal and rejuvenate. We don't listen to those body signals. We listen when we want to eat or sex. We don't listen to the important stuff that will really allow us to process and timestamp these things so that we no longer are stuck in it. Because that's essentially what happens. The trauma overloads our system. And we get stuck, and then we just get saturated and soaked in cortisol and adrenaline, which our bodies are not meant to hold for long periods of time. Cortisol and adrenaline are incredibly powerful hormones. And when they go into your bloodstream, they can save your life. They can get you out of there or make it possible for you to fight for your life. Yeah. When you're sitting for years with that stuff, it is not healthy.
Yeah.
You start getting autoimmune diseases. You start getting weight gain. I mean, the list is endless of some of the things that trauma can go in and just wreck your body. We're not meant to have all of our blood pulled into our core. We're not meant to have neuropathy. We're not meant to abandon our limbs to try to save our organs, you know? For years and decades at a time anyway.
Yeah, and it does. It just really, it does wreak havoc on all aspects of our body. You know, it contributes to the diseases that you just mentioned and the care challenges that you just mentioned. And, you know, you mentioned the point about safety. When I was a therapist, I worked with a lot of individuals who had substance use disorders, PTSD, who came from, had a lot of trauma from abuse. And the one thing that I tried to do before I did any type of therapeutic interventions that the client and I collaboratively agreed upon was try to create a safe space for them to just feel comfortable, to feel welcomed. You know, and I tell my students, I said, look, beyond your qualifications, if you want to get somebody engaged, particularly somebody with a history of trauma, create an environment that is welcoming, that is safe, that is structured, where there's consistency, where there is warmth, and you will, that individual will begin to connect with you. But trust that it's going to take some time. It's going to go in, you know, baby steps. But if you set the foundation for that to occur, you have those specific personal qualities that you can bring into the therapeutic relationship.
Absolutely. Yeah.
You're going to create a safe space for a trauma-informed client to deal with.
Yeah. Once you create safety and hold space to co-regulate with them.
Yeah.
A lot of people who are experiencing trauma, they experience the event either alone or because of their caregiver, which is why it's so traumatic. You have no one to co-regulate with. You know, can I tell you a story?
You can tell me one story, two stories, three stories.
Okay, I'm going to tell you a story. When I was born in Germany, in Würzburg, Germany, military hospital. My dad was in the army. In 1977, I got sent home from the hospital for 3 days. So we went home on the third day. And my father was sitting on the couch doing something, cleaning a camera, or he was in the photography, maybe doing something like that. My mother was in the kitchen making dinner. I'm laying on the couch on the cushion, wrapped up in a blanket next to my father. So he's sitting there doing something and I start crying. So I probably needed like a diaper chain or to be held or just to be reassured of safety. When I was raising my daughter, there was this thought that if a baby's crying, you just let them cry it out. If your baby's crying, there's a reason.
Absolutely.
That reason could simply be they need you to hold them. They need you to reassure them that they're safe and that they're loved and that they're enough.
Yeah.
This stuff all gets programmed during that first few years, man. And if you miss that spot, it's tough to recover it. So anyway, he picks me up as I start crying and he starts spanking. I'm 3 days old. He's spanking a 3-day-old baby hung upside down by my feet. I immediately stopped crying. My mom is standing in the doorway and seeing this happen, and she's just horrified by it. But what did that teach me as a little baby, right? It taught me that it doesn't matter what my needs are. I'm not enough, and they shouldn't be met. Not only that, but I shouldn't even let someone know that I have needs that need to be met, and I should never, ever show emotion.
Absolutely.
You know, so you fast forward 6 years and I'm sitting on the curb in front of my friend's house and there's this known fact that Russ doesn't cry. Even when Russ gets spankings, he doesn't cry ever. And that was because of 6 years of reinforcement from my father. Every time I would get in trouble and get a spanking and he would threaten to spank me even harder if I cried, you know, so I ended with these kids running across the street, drop kicking me in the face, trying to get me to cry. So that behavior of me sitting here on the curb for like 15 minutes, allowing these kids to drop kick me in the face to prove to them that I don't cry is a perfect example of our trauma driving our behavior.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, attachment to our parents begins to form at an early age, and if that attachment bond becomes compromised or is not strong or is weakened or is ambivalent, you carry that. I mean, and again, it's because early experience matters. And that was the first, one of the first things I thought about is the message I would have gotten is men don't cry. They don't show emotion. And that's obviously one of the things, especially for men. And, you know, like I'm a baby boomer, men in our, I think our generation, we learned that emotions were not to be expressed. We sucked it up.
Stoic.
We sucked it up. We toughed it up out. We took care of our family in times of crisis. And, you know, we just put our own needs, emotional needs, grief needs on the back burner. And that results in a lot of physical and mental health issues in terms of irritability, depression, chemical dependency, all of that can occur because of the message we get that emotions kept inward are best and not to be expressed.
Don't show them. Don't show emotion. Emotion equals weakness or pain. You know, either it's going to show them that you're weak or it's going to make you vulnerable to get hurt. A lot of us end up in loveless marriages that, and it's not necessarily their fault. It's not necessarily our fault. It's just this lack of emotion being shown. And then you end up leaving the person that you initially started out in love with. It's detrimental to every level of your life, to every aspect.
Yeah. And it does. It has far-reaching effects. Just shifting gears for a minute. I know, brain spotting.
Yeah.
What is brain spotting and how does that work in the context of doing trauma-informed coaching?
Sure. So the trauma-informed coaching is kind of a blanket term for all of the different modalities that I'm doing. The somatics are the body stuff. Brain spotting, essentially, have you heard of EMDR?
Yes.
So just to kind of let anybody know who doesn't know what EMDR, it's a bilateral stimulation that helps access the trauma while you're discussing it with your therapist to help drill down and really get in there and do deep work. And it's incredible. Brain spotting is for those people that can't access it. Either they don't remember it, so they can't access it through EMDR. It's way too painful for them to deal with to access it. You have about 10 trillion connections in your brain. So the idea is that in different spaces within your visual field of view are brain spots. And within that visual field of view, we can find a spot that accesses the physical response of the trauma. And then we hold space with that client while they're holding that gaze to allow that physical trauma to then process through so that your hippocampus can then type stamp it, put it in the past, and then you move forward from it.
How many sessions on the average does it take for brain spotting to have the desired effect on individuals who've experienced trauma?
You know, I'd say that you have an effect after the first session, you know, and it's hard to quantify healing, you know, it's not like you come to me and say, hey, Russ, I'm having nightmares and I do one brain spotting session and then you no longer have nightmares. First of all, I don't know what trauma we're dealing with because there's sometimes where I'll have a 45 minute brain spotting session with somebody and no words are spoken. It is literally them sitting with their somatic experience and processing through it and just me just holding space with them. Yep. And co-regulating with them.
Yep.
So it's hard to quantify how many sessions it would take to resolve an issue. But typically people come in struggling with getting this thing of work done. Or struggling with the relationship with my mom. And we have this wedding coming up. And I'm supposed to sit down and be around her for a couple hours. And I'm not sure how that's going to go.
Mm-hmm.
You have them think about it, talk about it, share with you, that will automatically trigger the somatic experience as they're talking about it and thinking about it. Once you have that somatic experience going, you ask them to label it 1 through 10 on severity. Once you've done that, then we give them a track that they listen to. It's a 5 hertz track that's like kind of like, what's it called? Binaural beats. Have you heard of binaural beats? Similar to that, but it's in a different frequency that accesses the alpha brain waves. Gets that going, and then we find that spot, and we hold that spot. But you don't know what you're actually accessing, because you're accessing the somatics. You're not accessing the trauma. You're not accessing the problem. You're allowing the brain to do the work for you. So it's client-led, and you're essentially just holding space while they do the work.
Yeah, and I think that's the best type of therapy, to have client-led therapy, empower them to do the work, and you just become a very compassionate guide and an expert guide in helping them get through trauma and just reprogram how their brain is actually responding.
Yeah, and really it's just allowing, because, you know, we talked about we don't show emotion. A lot of us don't feel emotion either.
Yep.
You know, as soon as we start feeling something, we do everything we can to avoid feeling it instead of allowing it to process. Because until it processes and completes that cycle, that trauma cycle, it's not going away. It's just stuck there, and it can't go away. The brain doesn't know if you're in danger of death or in danger of missing your car payment.
Yeah. You mentioned that when we start feeling too much, we'll do something else. I know for me, during my own period of trauma, when my emotions came up, I would find something to distract myself from, and I would get busy. I would do something. One of the things I've told my students at Utica University, when we talk about gender-specific differences in emotional expression, is that men and women feel emotions just as intensely.
Absolutely.
But we deal with it differently, you know, because of the way we were raised.
Because of societal norms. And yeah, you're absolutely right. Your parents taught you, the baby boomer generation, to be stoic. Yeah. And then that was passed on to us, you know, in different ways. I'm sure that your family was raised a little different than mine was.
Yeah, I mean, we had our own set of challenges, but, you know, growing up, I mean, I was raised as an only child. My father left when I was 5 years old, but, you know, we all had our own set of challenges. But, you know, I was fortunate that I had a mother who was the antithesis of my father and raised me. I was never abused. I always had everything provided for me. In some ways, I was doted on, Russ, as an only child. I am grateful because without my mother, I wouldn't be who I am today. But, you know, I had my own set of challenges, but certainly none to the extent that you had to deal with, you know, as an infant.
Here's the thing that's interesting, though, Dave, is there's no such thing as big T, little t. T is T. Trauma is trauma. It doesn't matter if that trauma is because you didn't get picked for a softball team and that created a core belief that you're not good enough, or you got trash dumped on your head in the middle of the night because you forgot to take the trash out, which made you think that you're not good enough.
Yeah.
The ultimate response is, I'm not good enough. And that's the core belief that ends up driving these fractures of our personality, these firefighter parts and these manager parts that just basically control our lives and take the cognitive thought out of our daily lives.
Yeah. And, you know, you make a good point, because with grief, it's like everybody has their own worst tragedy. You know, my worst tragedy was the loss of my daughter, transition of my daughter over 18 years ago. Your worst tragedy might have been something else, but can I meet you at the point of your worst tragedy? Absolutely. Because I can tap into the pain of mine and meet you at the pain of yours. So, you know, tragedy is tragedy. And you know, I mean, there's, like you said, no big T or little t. We just deal with the pain and we deal with the challenges that it has caused us and the pain that it's caused us. And we try to help each other move through that and reestablish ourselves in life.
I had a client that I worked with when I was doing my case studies, and we were talking about her childhood. Did you have any issues in your childhood? She's like, no, I had a really calm childhood. And I was like, well, can you tell me about it? She's like, well, my brother was always in trouble. So I kind of just stayed in the background and just stayed out of the way because they were always dealing with something with him. We drilled into it for about a half an hour, and finally she came to the realization that basically her childhood, she put on hold while her mother was dealing with her brother, so that she was silent and invisible so that she wouldn't be a hassle to her mom. And that carried over into her relationships as an adult. You know, so it's, even if your trauma doesn't feel like a trauma, it all boils down to that core belief. It all boils down to that little child inside of you and what that alienated belief is that they're trying to protect themselves from.
Yeah.
So we just start building these layers of parts of us that protect us from that exiled Belize.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense. And it's basically our response to what happens to the events that we're confronted with that dictate how we are and how we interact and the issues or that we have moving forward.
Mm-hmm.
And conversely, for the joy that we can embrace, certain responses to trauma may be resilience in reestablishing ourselves in our lives in a way that we are providing meaning and service to others and loving ourselves in the process.
That's the hard part.
It's really tough to show unconditional love to ourselves because we're our own worst critic. It's that self-talk in our head that tells us we should have done this better, we should have done that better, when in reality, maybe we did the best we could given the hand of cards that were dealt to us.
I've sat here, Dave, thinking to myself, oh, that was stupid. I shouldn't have said that. Oh, man, why did I say that? Or maybe I should have said this. I've been critiquing myself this whole time. We do it constantly.
Yeah.
We're constantly talking ourselves down, especially survivors of childhood trauma and childhood abuse, because that, I mean, the damage that somebody does to a child. When a child experiences a form of abuse, and a lot of times abuse isn't intentional. You know, I was abusive toward my children, even unintentionally. I love my children very much. I would never do anything to hurt them, but I did. I did do damage, you know, through some of the stupid decisions I made as an adult because I didn't know any better. Right. But the thing about a very young child is that child is picked up and spanked and sat down instead of nurture and love the way he was supposed to. That child has no choice but to internalize it and make it their fault.
Absolutely.
Because if it's the caregiver's fault, then they're in danger, right? Mm-hmm. But if it's their fault, then they can do something to make it not happen again.
Yep.
And then it just gets reinforced and reinforced and reinforced. And that really destroys the sense of self. And I can tell you, Dave, for 42 years, I don't know that I had a sense of self. You know, that was destroyed at such a little age that I went through life like a robot, basically being controlled by these parts and never actually enjoying my child growing up. You know, never really connecting with my first wife in ending that marriage and divorce, you know. Never really applying myself in certain ways that could have made me very successful, but I was being held back by a fear of failure.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, my ADHD, the inflammation of my body, the fact that by 22, I had 3 ruptured discs and 2 bulging discs. You know, some of that was military service, but a lot of that was trauma, just constant inflammation and pressure on the back. And just trauma is extremely useful when you're running from a tiger in the Serengeti.
Mm. Absolutely.
Not all that useful when you're driving down I-25.
No. No, you're absolutely right.
Yeah. Couple thousand years ago, when you were trying to survive in the wilderness, trauma was useful. Being stuck in trauma was even useful.
Mm-hmm.
We don't live like that anymore. Our brains are very poorly designed for the modern world that we live in.
Yeah, if we can figure out a way to redesign the brain to adapt to the modern world we're living with, we would probably win the Nobel Peace Prize or something to that effect.
I hate saying it, but it might just be turning the power off, man.
Yeah.
Can you imagine if 1 hour a night, all the power went off, and you had to light a candle and eat dinner together? You know, it's...
Yeah, turn all the power.
We were just go, 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 go. We've got our minds on 400 things at once. You know, have these people are doing meetings while they're driving down the highway in their car. It's incredible the amount of weight that we put on ourselves on a daily basis, and our bodies and our minds just aren't built for it. Our bodies aren't meant to sit down for 12 hours a day in front of a computer. And our minds aren't built for, we aren't meant to know what's going on in Gaza. 1,000 years ago, we didn't know what was going on a mile away.
Yeah.
Our circle was 30 or 40 other people, our friends and our family, people that we got along with and loved and cared for. Now we're connected to thousands of people. I've got thousands of followers on Facebook. I know maybe 50 of them.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, and that's it. I mean, the internet and technology has made things a lot more impersonal, and we have to make a really conscious, mindful effort to be more personal, to get up out of our seats and go see somebody, just if you're in the workplace, rather than email, walk down to their office, you get a little exercise, you get some steps in, and you have that face-to-face contact and human connection that we so sorely need at any time of our lives. And it's just doing those little things like that to reestablish that human touch.
Well, we've replaced this conversation. Dave was amazing. This has been wonderful, and I've really enjoyed it. But can you imagine if we'd been sitting across a table at a coffee shop talking to each other? It would have been so much more meaningful, so much more connection. 80% of communication is nonverbal, and a lot of the little micro movements and stuff that you pick up on when you're face-to-face, you can't when you're on the internet. And you certainly can't when you're posting AI pictures of yourself on Facebook, you know, or putting up the persona that you show everybody on Facebook. If I didn't have my business on Facebook, I probably wouldn't have Facebook. You know, there's a lot of toxicity out there. But the good news is, as I am healed, as I've done the work, and as I've altered the way that I think about things, the toxicity on Facebook that I used to feel like I had to try to fight just doesn't even bother me anymore.
No. Well, you know, I think you've developed your own resilient coping strategies. Plus, the other thing, I look at Facebook or social media, I use it for a specific purpose. That's to get the word out about my podcast, to network with like-minded individuals, to post inspirational stuff. And as long as I can, and manage other pages that I have. So as long as I keep that focused to a specific purpose, that isn't going to stress me out, that isn't going to cause my cortisol levels to go off the map. As long as I don't get involved in the social networking drama that seems to be so much a part of this now, I can empower myself to create my own spin or reality in terms of how I use social media. And the more I empower myself, the more liberated I become.
Absolutely.
And
the less you're willing to tolerate of things that no longer serve you.
Yeah. I mean, and I've learned to walk away from things that no longer serve me. I learned to walk away from people that no longer see my value. And, you know, I'm good with that, because for all the people I walk away from, or things I walk away from, there are other doors that are going to open up with the people that are going to be needed in my circle at that time, and the opportunities to do meaningful service work are going to open up. So, but we just have to empower ourselves to do that, and to think that we are deserving enough, and that we love ourselves enough to walk away from stuff that no longer serves us.
Right.
Bro, speaking of Facebook, tell us about your Facebook group, Men's Trauma Unlocking, what inspired it, what it's about, and what the impact has been so far.
So what kind of got me going on this whole journey of becoming a coach was a podcast that I was listening to by a woman by the name of Caroline Strawson. She ended up offering a coaching program that she built that is CMI and ICF accredited. Master's level coaching program. So I also did a couple other programs through her, and then I bought into the franchise. So I'm a brand partner in the mental well-being company. We offer trauma-informed workshops for public sector, schools, police, city employees, things like that. As being part of that community for the last few years, I've gotten to get to know Caroline relatively well. We did a podcast where I was on her podcast. So when she was shutting down the group that went along with that podcast, she asked if I would make that group available to her for the men coming through, because her group was only for women. I was already working with kind of a business coach to really define my demographic of people that I'm working with and people that I'm trying to reach with my social media and with my podcast. And that really became evident that it was men dealing with childhood trauma or PTSD. I've got a lot of friends who are military. I served in the military myself, so I can kind of relate to those guys. And then I've also got all the childhood trauma background, so I can relate to that as well. And I really wanted to work with guys that have struggled lifelong with trauma. So I created the group And it's kind of grown pretty quickly because of the people being fed by that other group that has been shut down since. The impact is still kind of to be seen. You know, I've definitely had guys respond. I usually, whatever I post on my page, I share it to that group, and I have a special post that I'll put in there. Right now, we're just kind of building the community. Once we get the community to a point where it's big enough, we'll start doing some like monthly mastermind calls. Well, we'll go on. I'll have someone like you come on with me and we'll discuss a topic. The men can come on with us and ask a question or type out a question anonymously that we can answer for them. Basically, like question and answer healing sessions or monthly free sessions for men in that group. And then obviously, it's for people to be able to get in touch with me that want to work directly with me if they're interested in hypnotherapy, brain spotting, or coaching.
Yeah, that sounds like a far-reaching group with a lot of potential to help a lot of men who are affected by trauma.
There's not a lot of guys. First of all, there's not a lot of men in the coaching space. So thank you for doing what you're doing in the coaching space. A male voice or a masculine voice in this space can reach people that a feminine voice cannot. You know, people like me, for example, I'm lucky that I was open to listening to it because of what I was going through with my ex-wife. I needed answers. So I started seeking them out, and that's how I found that podcast. Had I not been looking for an answer, I never would have come across it. So having guys out there talking about this stuff and being vulnerable, showing other men that it's okay to feel, it's okay to talk about the way you feel, it's okay to be vulnerable. In fact, it's a lot stronger to be vulnerable than it is to dissociate and drink yourself into an oblivion to try to hide from your problems.
Yeah, and I was, you know, you took the words right out of my mouth. I was going to say vulnerability isn't a sign of weakness. It's a sign of strength.
Brené Brown, I don't know if you're familiar with her.
I sure am.
She does. She tells a story. For those who don't know who she is, she's a researcher. And she does research specifically on vulnerability and courage. And she tells a story about she got on a plane and she sat down and the guy next to her struck up a conversation and basically asked what she did. And she said, I research vulnerability and courage. And his response was, oh, okay, cool. The two ends of the spectrum. And she's like, no, you cannot have vulnerability without courage. You cannot be vulnerable without being courageous first.
Yeah.
And you can't be courageous without being vulnerable.
Yeah.
So they go hand in hand. It's definitely not two ends of the spectrum. And I think guys, because we've been taught that stoicism from such an early age, you know, get swatted with a belt and you start crying, knock it off, I'll give you something to cry about. So we've just been taught not to be vulnerable because vulnerability is weak. My mission with that group, with everything that I'm doing online, with all the modalities that I'm learning, is to teach men that it is okay to be vulnerable. It doesn't make you less of a man. If anything, it makes you more of a man. When it comes to their children, men will fiercely fight for their children.
Yeah.
But they won't heal themselves for their children.
Yeah.
And that's the biggest gift you can give your children, is breaking that cycle.
Well, you know, Russ, I think men have also been conditioned, I think, to take care of their families, to be strong for their families. And one of the things that I think I read this in a book, it was by a female psychologist, and it was one of the better books I read in terms of how men and women process emotions. And one of the things is that, and this was really telling for me, is that when a man sees a woman cry, they're uncomfortable with it. Not so much because they're uncomfortable with the woman crying, they're uncomfortable with it because of what that crying signifies to the man. That crying signifies to the man that I didn't do my job taking care of my family. I couldn't protect them from the harm that befell my family. I couldn't protect them from my daughter's death. I couldn't protect them from my, you know, my son's death or my, you know, their grandfather's death, however that may be. But, and that's one thing. It's like a swift punch in the gut when we see our loved ones in pain because it was our job to protect them from it. We didn't do that.
Yeah, I can relate to that. You know, my daughter had some things happen to her when she was little that really affected her throughout her entire life. That was definitely her trauma. And, I was unable to have prevented that from happening. And that really makes you feel like a failure as a man, as a father. It even affected the marriage with her mom. It ended up destroying that as well. I think looking back, that was a big catalyst in the beginning of us, you know, terminating our marriage. At the time, I blamed it on her. It was all her fault.
Yeah.
Looking back, it was the trauma of what had happened to my daughter had soaked into other parts of my life to include my marriage. And just looking at her mom would remind me of that. It was difficult. I can say that now. I couldn't say that 20 years ago.
Well, you know, the passage of time gives us kind of more clarity, and we can look back on those things, and we acquire wisdom as a result of looking at our past and looking at our past missteps or misjudgments, however we want to phrase that. You look at it and you say, okay, this happened. What can I do now? What can I learn from that so I don't repeat the script again? And that's why I think the past is a valuable piece of information for us. I think it informs us of our present and orchestrates our future. One of my last questions for you, we got to talk about your podcast, Trauma Talks. Tell us about the podcast and what you want listeners to take away from it, Russ.
So I have a podcast called Trauma Talks with Russ Tellup. My original goal was to do weekly episodes where I discuss a different topic of trauma and healing tools. Then it kind of evolved into an interview space. I interviewed Chris Mamone on there. In fact, I think I was the first podcast he ever did. But it grew into that. This season, I just started the season up last week. This season, I'm going to tell more of my story, I think, and be a little more authentic with it. I got into it that I wanted it to be successful so I could help as many people as possible, but it ended up not being authentically me with all these interviews. And I think my story being as challenging as it is, and frankly, as powerful as it is, it's a story of survival, you know, that hopefully me sharing those things will make it more possible for men to open up and share theirs.
Yep.
That's ultimately what I would like it to do, and attract guys to this men's healing group and eventually to some of these masterminds and classes that we're going to start offering.
And if that's the case, you can get men involved in sharing their story. And that's going to also help men who are listening reclaim the narrative in terms of what they've been conditioned to believe about emotional expression and vulnerability. I think with the Gen Z crowd, you're going to see more intuitive males come about where they're going to lead with their feelings. But for our generation, the baby boomers, the Gen X, it was stoicism was the rule.
And it's a hard rule to break. It's a hard wall to knock down with guys from our generation because it was beaten into us.
Beaten into us and drummed into our heads that, you know, men don't cry, feelings are bad, suck it up.
So, yep, be a man.
Yeah, be a man.
So my response is be a man, talk about your feelings.
There you go. If you can leave our listeners, and you've left our listeners with a lot today, Russ, if you could leave our listeners with just one ultimate piece of wisdom today, what would that be?
I was 43 years old when I realized that trauma is real and that it was affecting me and that I was not in control. You are never too old. Your life can always be better. You know, facing these things and healing them is what's going to help you break the cycle with your children so that we stop passing this stuff on. It feels like if you feel like every generation is getting worse and worse and worse, you're right. And you can stop it.
Yeah.
But we can do it.
That's right.
And ultimately, you have complete control over your emotions, but you are the only person that has control over your emotions. And yours are the only emotions that you have control over. Focus inward and start trying to understand why you feel the way you do rather than being pissed off that you feel that way to begin with.
Those are great words of wisdom, great advice for our audience. Russ, my one final question for you today is if people want to get in touch with you, contract for your services, subscribe to find you on Facebook, what's the best way for them to do that?
So we're on just about every social media site. If you just look up my name, Russ, R-U-S-S, Tellup, T-E-L-L-U-P, just like it is down there in the bottom of the screen. The podcast is Trauma Talks with Russ Tellup, and you can find that under my name as well on YouTube. That's where that. That's where the video podcast is, and then the rest of the podcast platforms are all audio with the same name, Trauma Talks with Russ Tellup. Otherwise, you can go to brainspottingcs.com. That's my website for the brain spotting and coaching. If you're interested in the trauma-informed workshops, you can go to Russell, R-U-S-S-E-L-L-T-E-L-L-U-P, .thementalwellbeingcompany.com. There's a list of all the trauma-informed workshops that are available and things of that nature.
And I will make sure, Russ, that all of your contact information gets into the episode notes when our podcast goes live. Thank you so much for a wonderful conversation. I truly enjoyed it. I hope we can do it again sometime.
Thanks for having me, Dave.
My pleasure. And with that, that's a wrap on another episode of the Teaching Journeys podcast. I'm your host, Dave Roberts, wishing you peace.